Yeah.
Okay, we don't want to die. That's not on tape.
Good sex last night.
That's on tape. Yeah, it's all.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, just go. Anyway, we weren't really talking about that. We were talking about me yawning. Only not, and it was, had nothing to do with that, if you were.
Just showing off, I see.
Just, right, for posterity. Like I said, we kind of chronologically or factually are in that, you know, it stopped with you're coming, well, you were in China, well, you were coming back from China. And that's really in the middle of all your years at MIT, right? I mean,
yeah,
I didn't mean...
pretty much in the middle.
And we had, I think, covered an awful lot of just, like, the issues around the recombinant DNA and just what the program was like at MIT. The only thing I wanted to kind of catch up on, because we were talking about him this morning, or I was, with David Julius's, with Alex Rich, because you did mention on tape, and I kind of let it go because you didn't work very long in his lab, but that he was a very interesting fellow, and he'd been very supportive of your work all along, so I assume you have some, you know, relation with him and are able to shed some light on him and his lab and just what kind of scientist he was, or, I mean, you must have gotten something from him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I don't mean, like, a job recommended, I mean, in the way of
intellectually.
Yeah.
Well, he definitely sees the big picture of things. He's involved in the politics of science as well. He was a National Academy liaison to the Soviet Union in the 70s when I was in the lab.
Mm-hmm. And that entailed, did you have much sense of what it was, or it was just a matter of just keeping the avenues of...
I don't really know what he did in that. He was a member of the Pugwash Conference, so involved in nuclear disarmament issues. You know, he was a very genuine human being, interesting person, thoughtful, curious, cares about the answers to scientific questions. He had a lot of different things going on in his lab, and different people, different lots of different types of people doing them. You know, there were people were different enough, and the lab was big enough that there was a part of the lab that listened to the Boston Red Sox on the on the radio, and there was a part of the lab that listened to classical music, and you could go from one part to the other.
Mm-hmm.
These were people who normally wouldn't be together.
Yeah.
But,
you mean just as a personality thing as opposed to even a scientific interest?
Oh, yeah. I mean, very sort of, I don't know how to say it, disciplined, genteel people to...
Rowdies.
People who are rowdy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. I ended up going back to Alex's lab for most of my last year of graduate work. With Greg Petzko, I worked on the crystal structure of yeast triosphosphate isomerase. And our assumption was that this enzyme would be conserved enough that we could interpret our structure in terms of the known sequences of triosphosphate isomerases from other organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And in the event, it turned out that the fold of the yeast triosphosphate isomerase was similar or is similar to the fold of the chicken enzyme.
I guess it was chicken that Petzko had been working on, and then some other group had been doing bovine, or what was it? Oh, I'm trying to read.
Well, Greg had worked on the chicken enzyme in the early 70s, or determined the structure in the early 70s in David Phillips' lab. And I think at that time they had also worked on the rabbit muscle enzyme, but it was less tractable. The problem was less tractable.
Do you know why they were after that? Well, I guess the particular enzyme, but I mean, I understand why they would be after an enzyme, because, of course, it was Phillips' lab that was the first one to do the enzyme.
Well, I think we talked about it last time, and that is that David and Greg were both interested in trapping enzymes in action.
Right.
And so the isomerase was a particularly good system, because in theory you could just add the substrate and look at the complex of the enzyme in a real substrate,
mm-hmm.
rather than the enzyme and an inhibitor or a product.
But the chicken was just because it was available, and
I don't know the history of the work on on why they chose chicken. Rabbit muscle had been studied because there was someone at Cambridge who purified most or all of the glycolytic enzymes from rabbit muscle. So these proteins were all available, or they were purified, and people were trying to crystallize those.
Because, of course, I guess, you know, sometimes you think, maybe I'm wrong to assume this or expect it in the particular area in that you're working in or with these particular enzymes, but the yeast was such a well-worked-out system, it seems, compared to others, that usually that's where people started as opposed to...
No, in fact, it was just the opposite.
Yeah.
People didn't know much about yeast, Tim. Hartmann had purified the protein. Cernoglou had found crystals readily. I managed to crystallize it with transition state analogs bound while I was in Phillips' lab in Oxford. Also in Oxford, I found heavy atom derivatives, screened them by precession photography. And so when I got back to Cambridge in that January, I started collecting the X-ray data. I got back in the fall, and by January I was collecting the data.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we calculated the first electron density map on July 4th.
When you should have added a barbecue.
Exactly.
Science waits
for... It seemed like Independence Day, in a way, because all it was a first view of the molecule. And
the year, just again, I just want to make sure I get this right, it's 1980.
80.
Okay, yeah. I'm just 81, all right.
And the pressure was that Greg Petzko was going to a meeting on glycolysis and glycolytic enzymes in London at the end of the summer. And he had already agreed to give a talk on trisphosphatidylsomerase, but of course...
In yeast, no.
Well, it turned out that we didn't have the structure determined, and so there was some pressure. And I'd say to his credit, Greg was helpful and encouraging and taught me a lot, but he never sort of took over the project. He never sort of sat down and did it. So, for example, when we saw the first electron density map, he said, oh, that can be traced, but he didn't sit down to try to trace it.
Get out of my way. I've got till like August 5th or something. That's good.
And it was really an amazing display of patience and also his... what practice of teaching people in the lab rather than, you know, just doing everything for them. And he, I think, really sees that as a big part of his role, that people that come out of the lab should be independent scientists rather than, you know, just technicians.
Did you... okay, I'm sorry.
Anyway... I guess I was supposed to be talking about Alex Rich's lab, but... So, I was fitting... Greg was doing phase refinement on our derivatives that summer to try to improve the electron density maps, and I had never traced a chain through an electron density map before, and I kept making mistakes and mistakes and mistakes, and...
As a matter of fact, if I could even get you to kind of... Since you're going to be the first one who's going to talk to me about any kind of the steps, okay, with the purification, and, you know, and the crystal structure, would you mind telling me what you were doing wrong, in a sense, or the steps that one... Pretend I'm totally... don't pretend. I really don't know what you're talking about, in a sense of the steps involved, kind of. And if you could take a couple of minutes. I mean, obviously not
so... the goal is to get the position of every atom...
Right.
In the molecule, and these are big molecules.
So you kind of take different angles and...
Well, so the first thing is to purify the protein or molecule. It could be DNA or whatever. And in the trisphosphatidylsomerase project, that step was accomplished by Hartmann. And his group basically just sent us the protein.
Okay.
And so... Then you take the purified protein sample at several milligrams per milliliter, mm-hmm. say 20 milligrams per milliliter, and add salts or alcohols or long chain alcohols.
And this is the mother liquor.
Well, this is what's called a precipitant, yeah. and it's just to make the protein insoluble. And if you find conditions correctly, that is, we have to make a crystal. And if you set the pH correctly, or the salt concentration correctly, or the protein concentration correctly, and you have all the right counterions and the temperature right and all those sorts of things, you'll get a crystal. And the idea is that the molecule prefers to associate with itself rather than with the water, rather than being dissolved. Mm-hmm. And if you set up conditions just right, there's only one orientation of the molecules that is more stable or favored compared to the molecule being dissolved mm-hmm. in water. And that one orientation ends up being hopefully a three-dimensional crystal. Right? You could get two-dimensional crystals, which I'm sure you've talked to other people about or may mm-hmm. talk to other people about. And the idea of the crystal is that all the molecules are sort of lined up like tile in your bathroom.
Sure. So everyone it's an order.
Is ordered, right. The molecules are still moving, but they're intrinsically ordered in the crystal. And because they're all lined up, when the X-rays hit each molecule, the X-rays are scattered in the same direction by every molecule. So the crystal is an amplifier. And a typical crystal might have 10 to the 15 or so molecules in it. So the signal, the X-ray scattering signal that you get from a crystal is amplified about 10 to the 15 mm-hmm. times compared to a single molecule. So that allows, that gives you a signal that's strong enough to measure.
So it's kind of also like aesthetically really cool, I think. I mean, at least it's pretty amazing, a powerful tool, I guess, in the sense of its ability to show you something you can't see.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I guess I'm saying really obvious things, but I mean...
Well, it's not the same as having a picture of a single molecule. It's a space average and a time average.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe in the future...
I was going to say, but its accuracy must be... I mean, those averages... I mean, it's a pretty safe average, right? I mean, there's a pretty large sample in the sense of what you're averaging,
mm-hmm.
and you're really not off that.
Well, one of the controversial areas in crystallography now is how to deal with the problem of these averages. Typically, the product of a crystallographic study is a set of coordinates mm-hmm. for the atoms, and if the study isn't high enough resolution, if there's enough information about how much each atom is moving, that doesn't tell you much about the ensemble of structures
mm-hmm.
that the molecule populates in time.
It's just the most favored or
right.
kind of an ideal.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, you know, reading USA Today doesn't tell you about individuals.
I don't know if I'd tell you that was the ideal ever.
That are covered.
Okay.
So you end up, you know, with the average. And if you consider enzyme reactions, for example, as reactions where the substrate binds and then the reaction happens when the enzyme substrate complex adopts a reactive conformation.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that conformation is populated for 10 to the minus 12 seconds mm-hmm. or something like
right.
that. Basically, you never see it.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't see it in an X-ray crystal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so that question really arises, what do these averages mean and how do you represent them? If the how do you represent them sort of technically in the sense of crystallography? That is, what is the best way to model your data?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you interpret them biologically? Does the average hide the most interesting conformation, which mm-hmm. may be there in just a small fraction of the molecules for a small fraction of the time?
Are these pretty kind of much issues, I want to say ideological, but that's not the right word. Some of the intellectual controversies that have been come with crystallography since they were able to start crystallizing organic structures or organic molecules, or is this something that's really relatively...
No, it's a long-standing controversy right. that tends to get expressed in the simple question of, are crystal structures really relevant mm-hmm. for the biological functions of these molecules? And it's been addressed in a number of ways. That question has been addressed in a number of ways. And Petzko and Phillips are people who are very seriously involved mm-hmm. in that question.
Because the question bothers them too? I mean, because they really see the legitimate... I mean, they think the other, the raising of the issues are legitimate, or they just want to put it to rest? I mean, they're convinced of its usefulness and utility, and they just want to nail that down?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, and so, for example, Phillips' group has determined the structure of lysozyme in many different crystal packings.
To show that it...
And shown that the structure is basically the same. Mm-hmm. It's not a function of how it's packed in a crystal.
Right. It's a function of the atom itself.
Yeah.
And is that what you were, in a sense, what you were part of?
I was involved in another attack on a similar challenge, really, and that is to show that crystalline enzymes are catalytically active. And I guess it was,
the crystalline form, right?
Right, so you could take a crystal of a protein, add the substrate, and you'd get the product. So whatever conformation was there...
Was really there.
It still worked.
You weren't just making us a kind of in vitro, if you will, just to use the analogy, situation of, this is what it looks like in this when I put it in this thing.
Yeah.
Because I realize that some of those issues are long-standing and perhaps have been addressed more readily about, the use of solvents and what are you exactly doing to samples, and even in the purification process.
Yes.
That seem to be, that you can check that those have been done, that experiments have been done to check the fact that, yes, we are recapitulating what's going on in vivo and not inventing something else that tells us nothing.
Yes. So after you make a crystal, you shine the X-rays on it. X-rays are detected by some kind of photon counter, a Geiger counter, or a X-ray-sensitive film, or X-ray-sensitive
lots of different
phosphor.
Seems ways.
Yeah, there are new detectors now that have speeded this up mm-hmm. quite a bit. And then the problem is that when you collect the data, you get only half the information you need to calculate with a computer the distribution of electrons that gave rise to that pattern of X-ray scattering. And to get the missing information independent of any model, for large molecules, Perutz and others worked out a method called the isomorphous replacement method, where the basic procedure is to bind metals, large atoms, to the protein in the crystal. You make the assumption that the crystal without the atom, the metal, is exactly the same. It's just missing
mm-hmm.
the metal. And then you compare the X-ray scattering.
Mm. You get the same, not a mirror, I'm sorry, not a, but it's, what's the term that is used? To refer back to the non-metal. I mean, they have a relation that's always the same, right? The displaced one and the a replaced one?
Well, the metal containing crystal is called a heavy atom derivative. It's a term I used earlier. And basically, by making the assumption that the difference in the scattering is coming from the metal alone,
that's what, yeah, I'm right. Sorry, that's what I was...
It's
tempting to talk about.
You can basically get the scattered amplitudes for just the metal atoms that are in there. Okay. And it turns out it's fairly simple to solve the structure or to determine the position of a distribution of atoms that's that simple, you know, just a few metal atoms in a unit cell, a few atoms in a unit cell. That's a simple problem now. So the approach that's taken is to determine the position of the metal atoms, and then from those positions to bootstrap the information that was missing when the scattering from the protein alone was measured. Okay, so by using several different heavy atom derivatives that have different metals bound at different sites, you basically improve the consistency of this information that was missing from the individual measurement. And so by comparing the scattering from the heavy atom derivatives with the protein alone, you get the metal positions, you bootstrap the missing information. Mm-hmm. You do this several times, and the more times you do it in general, although that's not always the case, the more certain or the better your information is, the better the information is that you're using to calculate the electron density map. Okay. And Greg actually was someone who sort of drummed into people in the lab that in crystallography, virtually the only experiment that you do is to collect the data. And so this is something you had to do well, because every subsequent step depended on the quality of the data. So it was interesting that, you know, he had identified the key experimental step.
No matter what you were working on, or, you know, it was,
yeah,
the,
exactly.
It was going to be,
and
this...
Said, look, you have to, learn how to do this. Yeah. So, and you have to do it well, because that makes everything else more believable. Anyway, so we did that with trisphosphate isomerase, calculated the first electron density map based just on one heavy atom derivative. That was July 4th. And by the end of the summer, we had calculated maps based on up to three heavy atom derivatives.
Okay.
And it's a simple, I don't know how to say this, it's a simple thing, but one of the mistakes I kept making was to lose track of where the polypeptide chain was going through space. And one of the reasons for it was that we were displaying the maps so that they didn't cover a whole molecule. We just carved out a region of space and displayed that.
Just because it's a smaller space and easier to work with? Or
no, it was big enough to cover a whole molecule. It's just that the boundaries of our display didn't coincide with the boundaries of the molecule. Okay.
And so this is like a computer type...
No, it wasn't a computer thing. It was a physical map.
Okay, so this is something you're constructing, if you will, from...
Well, what it really is a stacked set of plastic sheets.
Okay.
And
it is really
each sheet has a contour map on it. And the more contours there are, the more electrons there are.
Got
so
it.
It's like each sheet has an altitude map.
Sure.
And, it's
and of course, they're in the article. I mean, okay,
yeah,
I
so
was
when
just
you
curious
stack
what you were
up,
using to...
Yeah, yeah,
to
no, it was a physical map in those days. And then you stack those up, and you look, and you see where the molecule is. And I kept having to go across the boundaries of the map, so go off one edge and come in the other edge to get... a whole molecule, and I kept losing track. So Greg wrote a routine toward the end of the summer where we could specify that we wanted to look at the electron density corresponding to a single molecular dimer. Okay, so that was one important step. And then the other important step in terms of mistakes is that I kept following the chain where it was clear, and then when I got confused, I would go somewhere else in the molecule and start somewhere else and follow that until it was clear, and do this over and over again, and I would end up with a bunch of pieces that were disconnected.
Oh, okay.
And the problem with that approach is that it's very hard to check the consistency of all these different little pieces.
Mm.
And so finally, we had an improved map, we had an improved display, and I took the strategy that I would start somewhere in the chain, not knowing where it was, and follow that continuously without jumping anywhere. And I would follow that continuously until I definitely came to an end, and then I would go the other direction. And I think I started that, you know, in the afternoon one day at the end of the summer. And essentially by 4 the next morning, I had the whole molecule. So this was, you know, in a few hours by just changing a few subtle things.
Okay. And this decision to kind of keep going and not doing was that just, it seems like then maybe, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, because it would be an important mistake, I admit, you know, and you'd want to, that you didn't want to at first, you were kind of doing more sampling because going straight through you thought was kind of like doing a lot of extra collection of information that you just didn't need, or...
No, it's that when you're following the chain through this map, there are lots of ambiguities.
Sure. Okay.
Because there are places where the electron density gets very weak, or it might do just the opposite. You might have something like a freeway interchange, which is coming from errors in the map. And so you have to decide which way to go without knowing what the right answer is.
And so this decision,
so basically you have to try out all these different possibilities.
You just tried them all out then. In other words, you hit every single pot. When you came to a freeway interchange and you didn't know whether you were going,
right,
you just went all the directions and to see where it would lead. And then
if I found something that was completely inconsistent, then I would pick the one that was consistent and follow that.
I see. Now, this is a typical situation anybody doing this kind of work might come across or have to deal with, although maybe it's easier now because it's all done on computer, or this can be done in, you know, in a different way, but I'm talking about at the time, or this was a particular problem or issue that you were facing with a particular, you know, fact that you were doing enzyme, or, you know, it was a really...
No, it's a common thing. It's a problem you face in every structure determination.
So everybody's kind of... Every grad student starting out kind of doing this is going to also kind of be facing the same sorts of issues about, you know, how do I follow this through? And that sort of thing.
Okay.
One thing that has really amazed me is, and I guess the best, you know, I think one of the places where it's put down the most clearly is in Judson's book, and that's, you know, the doggedness with which someone like Perutz would keep going after getting, you know, I mean, what we're talking some 30 plus years to solve the structure of hemoglobin, and while I think things are done a lot more quickly today, and there are a lot of methods. And some more rules have been found out for doing this sort of thing, it still seems to be very much an art and not a... I don't want to use the word science. I mean, it seems like you need a knack and you need to know how to, you know, a lot about biochemistry and, like, recipe making and mixing and matching and that sort of thing, and that, again, I think as we'll talk about as we go along here and there, I think a lot of the efforts in the area to regularize that, right, to get away from that. But at the same time, it's still very much this kind of, it's almost like an artisan working, you know, or a woodworker who, or a furniture maker who gets, you know, each thing is going to turn out different and be unique and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, although that there are still some lessons that can be handed down to an apprentice and that sort of thing. I don't mean to make it quite sound too medieval or anything, but that seems different than a lot of other areas of biological investigation. And again, I'm not meaning it in a pejorative sense.
Well, there are lots of pieces to macromolecular crystallography, so everything from purification to understanding activities to crystallization and dealing with heavy metal chemistries, and there's computing and keeping the instruments running. I find that's one of the things that makes it exciting. But I think if you talk about, you know, Perutz, one of the biggest things that he had to overcome is just the developing the methods and the instrumentation was.
Now I realize he really in a sense.
Yeah. So now. I would say the instrumentation is much more reliable, the computers are much faster. And we could talk about, you know, a revolution in methods, which has certainly happened.
While you were, in a sense, also while you were at it, really. I mean, although some of it happened before, certainly.
Yeah.
No, I very much like to know if now is the time where you want to get through a lot of your work.
We'll come back to that.
Okay, yeah. Because I've got kind of a list I'm compiling here of things we could talk about. So if you want to just go
but
on with
your own. I think there are parts of all experimental work which have art involved in it.
Right.
You know, how careful are you? What is your aesthetic about how the result looks, that you're willing to accept it, or how carefully do you look at the result to figure out what it means, and how do you get clues about what you should do next based on the result of each experiment? How do you know when to ignore an experiment you think might have some flaw?
And have enough sense that, you know, say, oh, I will add a little bit more of this, or,
yeah.
you know, that was a really weird result I got. Instead of throwing it out, I'll throw it in the freezer for 25 years or 2 months or whatever.
Yeah. And that, I think the other thing about being in Greg's lab that was just part of the atmosphere that he created was, in addition to doing the experiments well, you had to, well, his attitude was that the crystal structure was just the beginning. And up until then, or many people that were working at the time felt that, you know, crystal structures were the end, and once you determine the structure,
you throw it out there and publish it, and now you go on to the next one.
Yeah. But, if, you know, Greg, in a sense, made his career studying proteins whose structures, in general, were already known, and doing crystallographic experiments in general on those.
It
so
seems actually
Sarmray's, you know, wasn't one example where he certainly did determine the first structure, but then went on to determine the yeast enzyme structure as well, because it was a better system for studying activity. But certainly the work on myoglobin and the work on ribonuclease, that was very exciting. That was happening in the lab at the time I was there. These are all proteins whose structures had been published, you know, years before, a dozen years before. And, you know,
it seems like, you know, I guess, you know, you talk, you use the, you always double the term or the name to make the point, but he seems like the, you know, the protein crystallographer is protein crystallographer. In other words, instead of doing it for the sake of getting as many structures out there so that people can start looking at structure function questions, he seems to be constantly looking at the tools and instruments and the theories behind doing it to see if you can't, again, improve them or understand what their limits, or perhaps instead of their limits, you know, what their potential
In fact, I think
power
he's not the protein crystallographer's crystallographer. I mean, in the
that's
in
the
sense that he's
exactly
an excellent crystallographer, that's goes That is true.
Okay.
But people in macromolecular crystallography, I think, view him with suspicion or sort of as an outsider in some sense.
Because of the chemistry or?
Well, no, because he's not out there in general taking new snapshots of new molecules. He's studying how molecules work
mm-hmm.
in gory detail.
Maybe that's what I'm not, is.
So after Perutz determined, Kendra and Perutz determined structure of myoglobin,
mm-hmm.
One of the realizations was the extreme disappointment that the molecule was much more complicated mm-hmm. than they had envisioned. And then, of course, lysozyme was completely different, second structure. And that's
the third one was different also.
Yeah,
and the
exactly.
Nth one is
so it led to the idea that the solution to the problem of how proteins fold and function wasn't going to be available by solving one or two structures.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led people to think, well, there are these different sorts of substructures like alpha helices and beta sheets and turns, and maybe certain residues specify in a sort of hardwired way what structures will form.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea came about that, well, if protein folding was a problem that wasn't solved by determining the structure of myoglobin, maybe it would be solved by determining the structures of 100 proteins or 50 proteins or 10 proteins, some mm-hmm. number, just to get a database that was large enough mm-hmm. to find out statistically what kind of shape does each amino acid specify. And so that led to the drive or the goal that people would just go out there and determine structures, and it didn't matter what it was. It was just building up the database.
If it was an important, protein product or, product of an important gene, go do it, right?
Well, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It could have been toenail grease or something. as long as you could crystallize
the toenail grease gene
and get the shape, yeah, it was fine. And that effort meant that if you purified a protein and made a crystal and showed that it diffracted X-rays, you could get funded to solve the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And once you determined the structure, you could publish it in an important place. And for example, Brian Matthews tells a story that after they determined the structure of chymotrypsin in the 60s, the editor of Nature phoned them up and said, on a Friday, and said if they had the paper in London by Monday, it would be out essentially.
Right, the next issue.
Yeah. And so that's what they did.
Is this Maddox? Was he? No, he hasn't been the editor that long, has he?
No.
I don't know.
The 1960s, yeah.
I wish I had the time.
Yeah.
I could go back and find out all these things that, little questions that irk me.
Yeah. But the basic idea was any structure was interesting, and that was because it was building up the database and folding would be solved in a statistical way. And now that a few hundred structures have been determined and people have analyzed the database, there certainly are statistical preferences for what each residue would like to do, where it would like to be or what mm-hmm. shape it would specify, but that hasn't led to a reliable predictive method, and people have pretty much abandoned the idea that yet another structure will be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the situation is quite different, where if you crystallize a protein, basically to be funded to work on the structure, you have to show that it's interesting and novel and is worth determining that structure as opposed to a bunch of other things. Anyway, so How did we get onto that? I guess by saying that Greg's view
well, just,
is
yeah, and
to
just
analyze
kind of,
structures.
This also seems important because this was the milieu in which you learned to do all this or to care about it or that sort of thing.
And I would say that my bias for that developed in the lab, in Petsko's lab at the time, and certainly that's what I did during my postdoc is I went to Oregon and worked on the structures and properties of variants of the protein called fecal lysosome. And that structure had been determined, almost 10 years before I got there.
Mm-hmm. And by those folks.
Yeah, exactly.
By Matthews.
And so it wasn't like I was determining a new structure. I was analyzing the structural elements or the elements that gave that structure its strength or specificity of the fold.
This being, you know, after you were after the stability part of it, or the because of course that's what you're crystallizing is it, it, as we were talking about just a little while back, the kind of ideal or you know the protein the conformation of the molecule at its strongest.
We can come to sort of the details of, you know, what motivated that work and what questions we were asking. I think the point I was trying to make is that in Petsko's lab, it was a given that the way to do science, in the sense that it involved crystallography, was that the structure was the beginning, not the end. And that it was perfectly acceptable to go analyze a known structure rather than to solve new ones. And that wasn't true in every lab at the time.
And you think it's become more... But you think that most crystallographers are now kind of doing this... I mean, a lot of the area, no longer people are just turning out and struck... Yeah, I mean, that would have actually been my impression.
It still continues to be the case of trying to... Many people are just focused on trying to... understand new molecules or determine the structures of new molecules, and that's certainly, I'm not saying that's bad or it's not good science or anything like that. I'm just saying Greg's strategy included that, but also included analysis types of experiments. So the type of analysis that we did right away was to soak the substrate into trisphosphate isomerase. And this was done in a device called a flow cell that I think Cernoglu was the first person to use it in Richard's lab in the 60s to make heavy atom derivatives. But Greg had adopted it to be able to soak substrates into crystals. And for trisphosphate isomerase, the reason that we needed to do that was that there was an intermediate in the reaction process, so a short-lived state that was unstable. So we couldn't just add the substrate to the enzyme as you would think you could do on paper, because at a very slow rate, the enzyme broke the substrate in half instead of just interconverting two molecules.
Back and forth, back and forth.
And so we kept needing to add fresh substrate. So we did that with the flow cell. Unfortunately, when we added the substrate, the motions that the molecule underwent corrupted the order in the crystals. So... basically, it was like putting on glasses that were somebody else's, you know, and you couldn't see. All of a sudden, you couldn't see.
That's a nice...
You couldn't see any of the details. So we went from a situation where the normal crystals were such that we could image every atom, essentially, to less intrinsic order, and what that means is the molecules are all slightly... out of register, and so they don't scatter the X-rays in exactly the same directions, and so all the details are lost. But nonetheless, we did get a medium resolution picture of what the enzyme looks like in action. And that was, I would say, a really exciting time in the lab. It was exciting just to see the thing happen, obviously. It was exciting because we sort of beat the deadline for this meeting by about 2 weeks, you know, and I ended up going to the meeting as well and took our data in a box and went through customs in Heathrow, and you probably know in customs in Heathrow you just walk through if you have nothing to declare, and they pull you out of line if you look suspicious mm-hmm. or something. So here I was, this long-haired, bearded, wild-looking graduate student with a box. You know, and I went through with nothing to declare, but they
got me
out and said, "What's in the box, kid?" You know. And I said, "Oh, it's an electron density map," you know. And they didn't know what that was, so I showed it to them. And they said, "Well, what's this worth?" And I said, "I mean, how much did it cost to produce this?" Mm-hmm. He said, "Well, yeah, okay, how much did it cost to produce this?" I said, "Well, maybe $500,000.
They're like, answer. Value-added tax.
Yeah, I said, you know, the whole thing's worth like...
nothing,
right? $15.99, you know, the pieces are $15.99.
Yeah. That's how much is this worth? My life, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway,
declarable value.
That was fun.
Selling it to the Russians for...
Well... Unfortunately, I knew graduate students at MIT whose thesis projects were classified.
I mean, you mean biologists?
No, physicists.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, just there is somebody constantly, like a censor or a government official, constantly checking what came out.
They couldn't talk. They couldn't talk about it.
So, but I mean, they knew that was going to happen, and so they submitted it. Or there's literally somebody at MIT or somebody from the government.
Yeah, they're doing classified research, and then graduate students getting degrees.
Right, okay, and then so they knew they were in a classified lab or something.
Oh, yeah. So it's not such a joke.